This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Richard McCann, who will open up and open us up with an opening poem.
It's great to see you, Grace. This is a poem called After You Died. After you died, I had a body again, and I could recall how it had been back then to want things. Easy to recall that now. This sun-dazed room's lilacs in white bowls. But for a long time, I was grateful only for what your dying was taking from me. The world dismantling itself. Soon there'd be no more obstinacies. I wouldn't want anything again. After you died, I rode a bicycle around the lake all day in circles. I had come back. And so it was hard not to remember how it had been walking the path that circled the lake where I'd once gone each night to look for sex. It's true that I drank heavily. I was drunk. I walked until someone wanted me. But what did I hope to love in return? I followed him, his pale shirt disappearing into a small clearing hidden by shrubs. He undressed, his chest mottled by moonlight's shadow of leaves. If I could have followed you like that, even in grief, into a clearing littered with wadded paper tissues, white carnations. Mostly, I met no one. The path ended by the public toilets where I stood outside beneath the dim, caged street lamp in a body I hated. Without it, who'd need to ask the world for a thing?
That is the voice of Richard McCann. Is that Ghost Letters?
That's from Ghost Letters.
Oh, The intensely beautiful work of Richard McCann. He's known for his poetry as well as his fiction. He's an award-winning fiction writer, but we know him best as a poet and love him so much as a poet.
Well, thank you, Grace.
What work do you think you're best known for?
Fiction.
You won all those awards.
Well, I think also because, I mean, when you put fiction up against poetry and speak about, you know, like the number of books published and, you know, the fact that fiction gets, you know, wide reviews and you know, et cetera, I think fiction has, of course, I mean, obviously fiction has a much bigger readership. And I have a trade publisher as a fiction writer, you know, whereas I've been published by Alice James as a poet, so definitely fiction.
And you won the Hollins Critic Fiction Prize and the Hollins College Writing Fellowship. And your books include Ghost Letters, Things Shaped in Passing, Mother of Sorrows, which is in several languages, Nights of 1990, Dream of the Traveler, Landscape and Distance, which you co-edited with Margaret Gibson.
A long time ago.
I knew her in 1968. Boy, are we old friends or
what? That's the same year I met Margaret. And I was a college student, and she was a young college teacher. And she was the first person ever to read these things I was calling poems that I was writing. I just started. And she went through all my poems very kindly. And at the end, she said, here's a line that's good. And actually, it was very useful because I spent a long time dwelling on why that one line was good.
You know? Did you go to George Mason?
No, I taught with Margaret at George Mason. I went to Virginia Commonwealth University, where Margaret was teaching briefly when she was in Richmond.
I see. Richard McCann. He's an icon in Washington, D.C., and I love him. I asked him to bring his favorite poem to begin with, and then he brought, in his own generosity, a favorite poem of someone else. So let's hear Marie Howe's.
This is a poem by Marie Howe that I really dearly love, and I think I love it in great part because of the way it moves from scene to exposition at the end in time just jumps open at the end of the poem. It's a poem called The Boy. It's a memory from childhood, and it's from her book, her extraordinary book, What the Living Do. The Boy. My older brother is walking down the sidewalk into the suburban summer night. White t-shirt, blue jeans, to the field at the end of the street. Hanger's Hideout, the boys called it, an undeveloped plot, a pit overgrown with weeds, some old furniture thrown down there. And some metal hangers clinking in the trees like wind chimes. He's running away from home because our father wants to cut his hair. And in two more days, our father will convince me to go to him. You know where he is. And talk to him. No reprisals. He promised. A small parade of kids in feet pajamas will accompany me, their voices like the first peepers in spring. And my brother will walk ahead of us home, and my father will shave his head bald. And my brother will not speak to anyone the next month, not a word, not pass the milk, nothing. What happened in our house taught my brothers how to leave, how to walk down a sidewalk without looking back. I was the girl. What happened taught me to follow him, whoever he was, calling and calling his name.
Richard McCann, I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress. Richard is a man who is a professional poet, and that means he writes, and he teaches, and he edits. I think you did a lot of work with Murray Howe on the AIDS edition, didn't you?
Actually, I co-edited that with the poet and memoirist Michael Klein, but Marie was instrumental in having that happen, and her work is quite generously in there. I mean, she's a poet whose work has meant a lot to me, and I think she writes with an extraordinary clarity. Actually, one time I remember walking down the street in Provincetown with her and Tony Hoagland and Mark Doty and someone else.
It's quite a sidewalk.
It was quite a sidewalk. Provincetown is a great place. And Tony Hoagland it was snowing. It was a snowstorm. And Tony Hoagland said, "Oh, I can tell you how each of you would see the snow." And Mark Doty said first, he said, "Well, how would I see the snow?" And Tony said, "Oh, Mark, for you, the snow would be about transcendence, you know." And I'm sure I said, "How would I see the snow?" Although conveniently, out of vanity, I've forgotten what he told me. But then Marie said, "Well, what about me? How do I see the snow?" And Tony said, "Marie, you're the only one who would see the snow as snow."
Good explanation. Good description of Marie.
Yeah.
Richard.
And of what one might strive for in a certain kind of poem.
Yeah. Richard McCann, what place does writing have in your life?
Well, I'm teaching full-time during the semester, so it actually at this moment has a marginal place, it seems to me. I'm a professional reader of the works of others. But what place it has in my life in a broader, sort of more spiritual sense, I guess. I mean, it is the place to which I go to sort things out. But also, I have a really strong desire, and I don't know where it comes from exactly, but all of my work, whether in fiction or in nonfiction or in poetry, really has autobiographical sources. And one of the things my writing means to me is that by the time I die, I would like to feel like I'd used up a lot of my life, you know, that I'd sort of been using it up as I went along. And I don't want to leave a lot of residue. I'd like to get stuff, not just into books, that's not the point, but to get things sort of shaped into things other than experience, but things sort of outside myself.
That is such a tidy way of looking at it, putting things back.
Especially from such an untidy person.
Let us hear a poem, Richard McCann.
This is a relatively new poem, and it's called Later, and it's a short poem from a longer sequence. Later. What I regret most is standing at your hospital bedside day after day, believing what I did then would make a difference later. When I got home at night, for instance, and sat awake listening to those old LPs, did you ever hear a whippoorwill? I'm so lonesome I could die. It was you who died a few days later. You wouldn't have survived even if I'd stood there forever, bringing you magazines or glasses of water. He's dead, the nurse said when I got there that morning. And afterwards, I'd be restored, I thought, back to what I remembered as an afternoon's elegance, sitting by the pool on a chaise lounge, waiting for my life to come along and claim me. Soon, I thought, soon.
More. We want more.
We want more poems?
We want more of you. Yes.
Okay, I'll read you another poem from that same sequence.
The sequence have a title?
No, it doesn't actually, because I've never finished the sequence. It's really based on a lot of little moments from the 1980s when my former partner was dying from HIV-related complications. And they're just trying to capture little moments in the neighborhood in which we lived, which was Adams Morgan. And so I'll read one. It's actually set in Adams Morgan in Washington, D.C., and maybe some people from Washington might recognize the store. the two stores that are mentioned. It's called The Neighborhood 1987. I love these dating things. I always think of it as a kind of a tribute to Gavafi in all of his dated poems. But The Neighborhood 1987. There was a corner grocery, La Tienda Juanita. Its gaudy window stuffed with communion dresses, mangoes, baby dolls. There was Henry's soul food carryout, barbecue, pork ribs, half smokes, fried fish on bread. You see, it really was another era, that old life. Though I thought it could go on forever, you and me, and the elaborate hope we called our ordinary happiness, though it wasn't true, not even then. We had a condo. We had a blue sofa, imprinted with white lilies. We had two Breuer chairs. As to what happened next, at night you sat on the sofa, fingering the swollen lymph glands in your neck. Don't do that, I told you.
Oh, did you have a blue sofa, Richard?
No.
You made that up?
I just thought it needed a blue sofa. I think we had a black sofa.
Well, if a blue sofa makes me cry, keep it. It makes you cry. The
blue
sofa
makes you cry. That's my idea of fictionalizing. It's changing. I think it was a black sofa into a blue sofa.
Yeah. You did it so well.
Thank you.
But this should be a book. I mean, these particular discrete poems will be a section of a book?
I don't know.
A chapbook, maybe.
I've been working so busily on prose. I mean, with Mother of Sorrows, which is a collection of linked stories. And right now I'm working on a memoir, a prose memoir, which is a collection of autobiographical essays that sort of or about illness and mortality, and they're all derived from my experience of having had a liver transplant 12 years ago. So it's about what a book of prose, about what it means to live in a body like mine that's been kept alive by the death of a stranger.
We will be hearing a little bit of that, I hope. How do you get intimacy with your poetry?
With the reader?
With you, with your words. How do you get close?
Oh, you know, it's funny because I think of it so much in terms of intimacy with the reader. I'm not actually thinking.
No, it can't happen there unless it happens here.
Well, I suppose you're right.
I mean, how do you get, so I can write words and sometimes they are just so distant.
Oh,
but
I know
your
what you're
words,
about.
You are so close to your words. How do you do that?
Well, I think about Marie wanting snow being snow in the first place, but that is to say that, I mean, I'm not interested particularly in things that are distancing like metaphor. And so, I mean, metaphors that derive from the literal are terrific for me, but things that aren't. But I went to school to be an actor. And for me, writing really has its sort of primitive basis in the Stanislavski method, that is to say, re-entry into scene.
Do you still act?
No, not, well, and only in the sense that, you know,
can
like
you
everybody
read?
Else, I'm trying to live a life.
But would you read? Acting. Would you read a script if someone gave it to you? I mean, are
no,
you?
No, it's been too long ago. And I went, I think, it was college, and I went to this acting school thinking that I would be, you know, play great dramatic parts. And thanks to physiognomy, I was endlessly being cast as the Southern sheriff, you know. And this was not the life I had imagined. I think I thought I was going to be like Joan Crawford, actually. But indeed, I was the Southern sheriff.
Well, know. The life that you have imagined is poetry. So give us another.
Another poem.
And tell us what book it is from. People can still go in bookstores and ask for it, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read you a poem from Ghost Letters. And I'm going to read you a poem that's a very small little poem called Haunted Jukebox. At night, it's clear I love you. The glass you drank from on its side, crusting in the sink. You, not here, and I drawing the perfect flower, which approximates a bomb or an ear, flattened from the silence on the phone. There are two kinds of nights, really. One where I forget you, and hear dogs in the woods digging through dumped garbage. I return to my work, sewing slivers of mirror on your pillow, not to hurt. The other is like tonight, imagining you're collapsed in your chair after a long journey back to me. Let's make love is the song that's playing, and I rinse out your glass again and fill it with water too cold to drink.
Alice James Books, I think still in print.
Oh, yes.
And if you look on A Libris, it's probably there for 50. They always put books up at like 10 times what they were worth. Have you seen
it
lately?
If you go right to Alice James' website or to Amazon,
you'll get one. You'll save six. So do it. So they have the website and it's still posted, right?
Yes. And Alice James has kept this book in print through a few editions. One thing, Alice James is great at many things. That's one of them.
Ghost Letters, one of my favorite books. So Richard McCann, would you say that there is a vulnerability in your work?
I hope so. I mean, I don't find work very interesting that is as a reader, I don't find work very interesting that is invulnerable.
Well, let us tell everyone, once and for all, why vulnerability is strength. I mean, I don't know the answer.
Oh,
so.
I thought, why is it?
I
don't know if I could answer that question. I think that what interests me in the act of reading and thus in the act of writing, I mean, I like most people, as a reader first. Goodnight Moon is still one of my favorite books of all time. It is. I read it regularly. And after that, The Runaway Money. But it takes us a while before we get to Philip Roth's Everyman. What appealed to me most in reading was the sense of the human voice. And the first poets whom I read, who were largely what are now called confessional poets, like Anne Sexton and so on, were poets who were really speaking in ways that were intensely intimate and speaking in voices, angry, sullen, joyous, whatever, that were more extreme than the voices I had heard growing up, which were more polite, you know. And so the kind of intimacy and the sense of being able to stretch a voice by speaking or hearing with someone in intimacy was initially incredibly compelling to me and has remained so through these, you know, decades.
Amazing, isn't it? The things we heard in poetry were so clear, and the things we heard in our household were so confusing that I think you just chose that path through your life, clear things up. I would like to hear another poem, and then I want to go into the intention of your work and actually what it comes from.
The intention, that's an interesting word. I'm going to read one more poem from Ghost Letter. It's called Ghost Letter. It's the title poem, although it's not particularly meaningful. And this poem actually was just recently came out on a CD as a song by Darren Hagen, one of his art songs, Ghost Letter. Tonight the Chinese lanterns along the dock could lead your ghost to water. The departing ones need light, for their sight has already dimmed. As for me, I'm sitting at the edge of the old canal, whispering this ghost letter, staring at the moon. Dear friend, there is no one pitiable in this life, no pitiful abundance. If you saw back into this world, you would see me by the hydrangeas, still trained to the chain link fence where you first took my photo. If you have the inclination to look back, that is, if the dead are changeless, if the gravesite is something other than a way of having in the end. When you were dying, the hospital chaplain stood in the doorway. She said we should be tending to your immediate journey. She said we should take turns sleeping. She said the room was too cold for words. And someone told her, quiet. Don't you know the dead go on hearing for hours? What might I have said? I had made so many promises. According to one book I'd consulted, the autumn fields were set afire after harvest to warm the dying as they rose.
I get the same feeling from everything you read. So therefore, you must be doing something that is tried and true in the writing of it. What are you doing that you're so sure of that it gets the same response?
Know that I'm sure of anything, but in prose, I mean, in poetry recently too, I've really tried to develop more of humor, actually, sardonic humor as it may be. But I think I'm a very, good Irish boy. You know, I remember in an interview, Colm Tweedie, the novelist, being asked, you know, do you think of yourself as a gay writer? And he said, oh no, he said, I'm Irish, so I'm a very sad boy, you know, and I'm a sad boy writer, and I'd love to stretch that out, but it's sort of part of the intense Irish Catholic household in which my parents could quote from Long Day's Journey into Night, in which I grew up. But what interests me, I guess, you asked about intention, Grace. Is that the right word? You know, reading that poem out loud, I was just struck. The memory that came back was always the fundamental thing, that I'm someone whose father died suddenly when I was 11, and it seems to me that a lot of my work is not only about loss, but is an effort to kind of push back against or to even compensate. Or I'm thinking of something Joan Didion said in her famous essay on keeping a notebook, that writers are people with anxiety about loss, you know. And I think writing for me, not always at the conscious level, you know, but sort of at the deeper level, is really in some way about loss, coping with, but also trying to establish some little wedge against it.
Excellent. Richard McCann is at the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri, and I don't want to let him go for a minute. We'll talk now about what was not lost in Richard McCann, like your life.
My life.
And your new memoir is going to chronicle the fact that you are a well, healthy person in spite of quite a dramatic and tumultuous experience.
Yes. This new memoir I'm calling The Resurrectionist. And I mean by that two things, actually, because I often say to my friends, I'm simply trying to look lifelike. But before I had a liver transplant, I was very fearful that I would look extremely odd, like on big doses of prednisone and stuff. So looking normal, as it is for many people who have had a lot of serious illness, is a huge thing. But The Resurrectionist is a title I'm using, at least at present, because it suggests, of course, the idea of a resurrection and Lazarus and other images that are extremely important to me. But also, resurrectionist is a slang term from the 19th century for a grave robber. And so I'm also really trying to write the shadow side of transplantation. That is to say that my life is predicated upon someone's death. I would not be living without the liver of someone who had died, someone who I think of every day. And, you know, what it means to be, in a metaphoric sense, obviously, you know, sort of a grave robber. And by that, I don't mean something simply grisly or like shocking. What I really mean to be investigating is, in some ways, the ways in which life and death are completely dependent upon each other. In fact, you know, are obviously not separable, and that we cling to these words, life and death, as separate categories in ways that are fictive.
Will this book be out soon? Can we get this book? What's the title?
The Resurrectionist.
And that is going to be published by whom?
I don't know. I haven't submitted a proposal for it. I won't even speak of it.
Is it finished?
Not to jinx it. No, it's not finished. Everything by me is a long, slow way.
It takes you a long time?
Well, I write prose. I write prose the way I write poetry, which is to say word by word. And I like a look of agony because I know it's true, said Emily Dickinson. And I evidently seem to like that look on myself, horrifyingly enough.
I have a feeling you like what you've written about this book, so please tell us a little bit. Can you read a bit?
I'd be glad to read a tiny bit from it. I do rather like it, and in the sense of wanting to use up my life, certainly writing about this transplant has been a very important part of that. And I will just read a very tiny beginning from the first essay in this book, and it's the title essay, The Resurrectionist, and I'll just read the first little paragraph or something. Here is what happened. I was cut apart. The liver of a dead person was placed inside me so I might live again. This took 12 hours and 33 units of blood. But who was I afterward? I could still recall the body I'd had when I was 10, the body in which I carried what I called myself, walking along the C&O railroad tracks or crossing the divided highway that separated our house from the woods. A heavy, modest body, dressed in husky-sized jeans from Monkey Ward. I could recall the body I'd had, nervous and tentative, when I first made love at 17. But these bodies were gone, as was the body into which I had been born, these bodies I had called mine, without hesitation, intact and separate and entire.
Whoa, Richard, this is going to be it.
I hope. Well, thank you for that whoa. One always hopes for a whoa.
I mean it. Can you read more?
Sure. I'll switch to
this looks like it was published, this essay.
Yes, a number of them have been published. I've been publishing them as I go along.
How many have
been? Four have been published. Mm-hmm. And it's been fun to publish them as I go along. So
Who takes them? Literary magazines?
Actually, one's been in Tin House and the others have been in the Washington Post magazine, which has been a great spot for me. I really love writing. There's an editor there whom I really love working for. He's terrific. And it's also been a great spot because they work small, which is to say things are at 14 pages, and that's the size I can sort of do. I'll read you just one more little paragraph that explains the title, actually. And it's the beginning of the second part of this essay. "We are made of the dust of old stars," our grade school teacher told us. "We are made of leaves and sediment and the mulch of life. But I was made also of something rescued from the graveyard," I realized after the transplant. "And if I was now among the resurrected, I was also the resurrectionist, the name given in the 19th century to the grave robbers who sold corpses for dissection to physicians and anatomists trafficking in bodies and parts." I guess I'm kind of after here, Grace, is, you know, after the transplant, people often said it was a miracle. And indeed, although I don't know the word meaning of the word miracle, you know, and I think people meant it in a secular context, you know, it is a miracle. There's no question about it. But there was also, in the sense of asking, well, what happens after the miracle, after the blinding light of change withdraws and things on Earth resume their shadows? And a lot of this book is really not about, it's not a medical adventure about like waiting for a transplant, but it's a much more meditative book about what it means afterward to have an identity that feels sundered and fragmented and to cope with, you know, to cope with something that is at once traumatic and completely life-giving.
What does it feel like?
Oy, if I could say that, I wouldn't write the book.
Okay, wait. Yeah. But it's something you think about all the time.
Not all the time. You know, it's been 12 years since I've had a transplant, and I've again fallen under the delusion a lot of the time that I'm a normal person.
Well, can it be yours, like an adopted parent loves a child?
Can a donor?
No, can the liver, can you someday wake up and say, this is mine?
Well, that's a tough thing. I mean, I take immunosuppressive medication to avoid rejecting the organ as foreign, and I do that every day of my life. I take this medication several times that reminds me, but I think of it as ours.
Oh, that is great. Oh. Did you put that in?
Well, not in that word.
I love that line, though.
It's a way of opening the self, and
it's a great line. I think of it as ours.
Thanks.
Great. Do you know who it came from?
I believe I do, but I don't speak of that.
Does it matter?
What mattered to me in not knowing, and it still is important to me, is I come from a family of Irish Catholics who marry only Irish Catholics, and I have that twisted gene pool that's extremely tiny, and I loved the idea suddenly that my identity was now open in a sense. Like, I didn't know if the liver I was bearing was male, female, black, white, you know, whatever. And so, you know, for instance, sitting on a bus, I felt like I had sort of expanded my own sense of identity. I could look at, say, the man from, Pakistan across the aisle on the bus, and I suddenly would think, am I related to him through my liver?
Richard, I love it.
Thank you, Grace.
Give us a closing poem.
A closing poem. I'll be glad to do that. I'll close with another little poem from the series from which I was reading earlier. And I will end with a very short poem called Garden. You think you'll see it coming for miles that last time. And then the orderly wheels away the body, and what's left is the immense stupefaction of one thing. No, not coming back. The weeks before you died, I stood each morning in the garden, clipping roses, thinking that if only I could learn their names, Ocarina, Black Madonna, Crimson Glory. It's almost comical, isn't it? That kind of faith in words. I thought they would make things last forever, which is why I kept saying them. I love you. I love you. I love you.
The voice of Richard McCann. He will come back when his book is published so he can tell us how to write a memoir. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Richard McCann. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we'll be right back. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and we are back with Reb Livingston, and she's going to rock you. Here's Reb with an opening poem.
God gets close. You scratch the garnets on everything you unclasp. There's a missing set of silverware and a freezer full of untouched waffles. God gets close, and you depart with only trinkets in the night. You are the hand in the pocket of a ghost with a waning appetite. Tomorrow I'll drop an opal down my camisole and draw a map.
Reb Livingston, how you get drama in your poems, we will have to find out. She's the author of several books. One is Your 10 Favorite Words, Coconut Books, and then Soar Again. And that is a whole coconut chapbook series. She's the co-author of Wanton Textiles, No Tell Books. And her work has appeared many, many places. American Poetry Review, Coconut Me Poesius. And I knew her first, actually, when her poem was entered into the best poems of 2006. Seven?
2006, the Billy Collins edition, Best American Poetry.
And Billy Collins chose your poem?
I'm shocked, still.
What did you think?
When I got the email, it's from David Lehman's assistant, I opened it up thinking, oh, yay, a poem from No Tell Motel got selected. I just assumed it was something I had published and they were informing me. And when I saw it was my poem, I about fell over.
What was the title of it?
That's Not Butter. And it's very unlike most of my work. I wrote it. This poet who I'm friends with now, but I didn't know him at the time, on his blog, he put out a call for tiger poems. Schaefer Hall, who I didn't know at the time, he was going to do a chapbook on tiger poems. And I said, oh, I'm pregnant. I'm sick. I'm laying on the sofa. I'll write this tiger poem. And so it was based on the story that when I was a child, which wasn't that long ago, in the 70s, in kindergarten, we learned, you know, we were read the story Little Black Sambo. And, you know, of course, I didn't, as a five-year-old, I didn't get a lot of the racial implications, you know, anything like that. And so I just loved the story. You know, little boy tricks a tiger, gets pancakes. And so I rewrote I rewrote it. And a lot of people don't, especially people my age, because they don't know the story, because I'm from a little steel town outside of Pittsburgh, and they're about 1,000 years behind the rest of the world. But it was based on that.
We believe that judges choose poems that are like their own sensibilities.
And it was a narrative poem. It was straightforward. It read like a story. You could read it once and get something from
Bingo.
It.
Bingo.
And that's
Collins.
Not like all my – and that is Billy Collins. And it was the only poem I wrote or published that year that even had a chance of being selected by him. And I'm still really surprised.
Reb Livingston is making a big, meteoric swath through the sky of poetry. And she is out there. She's producing. She had a poetry series in D.C. She has a magazine online. She has a blog. But most of all, she is a poet that is dazzling. And please read us a poem. Reb Livingston, I'm Grace Cavallari.
He will. He will want the vulture. He will put on a cotton button-down and tuck your kisses in his collar, ring around the rosy. Oblige the whorehound. Oblige all his throbbing man parts. This is how you seduce him. This is his nice to meet you hat, and this is your throes into woe hat. This is how you lace your bra, and this explains curtains, and what possibly could you better do with this extraordinary walking cane except beat down those amorous arms, make them flail faster, bound down harder. This is how you deduce him. Lean into his face when speaking. Stare at his pretty chin. Don't threaten a vulture perched on his shoulder. It knows the meaning of humans and hasn't eaten for months. You're not human. You're like the Marlboro man. Horse dust, salt, death sex, dust lust. He will want the vulture to stay. Oblige them. Show your pockets. This is how you reduce him. Ashes, ashes, he falls in love.
Terrific. I understand that poem. What does this make of me? I wish I could sit inside of your brain and just watch all those words come through, though. That is what a trip. If someone said, Reb, and never had met you or read you, describe your poetry, what would you say?
I find that to be a difficult question. my process is, I have a lot of friends, poets, who they'll go places and they'll observe and they'll take things in and they'll write. You will never see me writing a poem on a subway or on the bus. I have to be in a room with nobody else with the door closed. I write from within. And what happens is I'll write a poem. And I'm not saying I go into a trance or anything silly like that. But
you do go into a trance.
I turn off part of my brain, I suppose, or something else turns on. I couldn't tell you exactly how it works. But when I go the next day or the next week to revise and edit, I often don't remember what I wrote, and I'm often very surprised by. And it seems like the less I remember, the better the poem is.
Don't stop now. Keep up that process. That poem is a very sexy poem, and your poems are very elegant but very seductive. A bit of a temptress in your language. And you wonder how Ashes and Ashes came through your brain that day. You know, I find you startlingly original. And that is something I crave and look for everywhere. And I think that's why you're making such a big splash. So be original in front of us and read a poem.
Okay.
Reb Livingston is her name. We're at the Library of Congress.
At Last and Everlasting. This is where we surpass the love of mothmen and mothers, and foretell burnt wings, death by hummingbird, estimators arriving much too late to the scene. And this is usually when he laces her back, and then his coffee. There's hot comfort on the side, comfort belonging to someone else. And he named the island after another because the name he wanted was forbidden. And it began in a valley ravaged by cargo trains, dragging loads of coal, dusty, smutty coal. Suck the coal, pray for the coal. What's wrong with you? She specifically said, never kiss the coal, and there you go, quarreling with bed lamps, attracting the wrong creatures. Pick these walnuts, peel the rot, watch these girls. These ones aren't permitted past the church, and these can go till the end of the lane. Whatever you do, don't let them rip off the wings. Girls are so cruel. Coal-sucking Venuses, cartwheel-thrusting harlots. Now, when he says coming through, he means passing through. That means you ready the casserole and let him roll. And she means it all, every bit, and knows that cornbread will make you sick. And there's tainted tuna for dessert, and those late trains that she doesn't want you talking to sound amazing, and they're totally different in the dark, fluttering, channeling their depressing little omens, dreamy romantic trains and moths chugging towards that light. And she's threatening to hang herself, and she's asking for $50, and she has a cat, and there's a lot of foreclosures in this city, and who would have thought anti-lock brakes would shake like that? And who would have thought kissing coal could be like this? There's 1,000 chemical reactions, and they all warm apples into decay, apples loving their creaking branches even after dropped, watching from the ground. Those apples know all, the squirrels pilfering nuts, lavish, deceitful squirrels, brown, licey, beautiful squirrels. It's time to rethink the medication. Time to give up the ghost. She doesn't see it anyhow. She's shutting the ambulance door. The girls whisper, emergency. The girls twirl their mustaches and tie the specter to the tracks. The girls tell the specter to step into that light and leave their moths alone. Bitchy, home-wrecking wraith. Dirty, train-hopping banshee. It's a miracle. It's forever. We're doomed. We're wearing matching smarty pants. We're disasters. We're marooned, festooned with soot and stickiness. We've come a long way through all that haze, on the backs of insects, streetlight by streetlight, endless blocks ahead.
Reb Livingston. My husband said, what does Reb stand for, Rebecca? I said, no, rebellious.
It does stand for Rebecca.
Okay. Coming from a little place outside of Pittsburgh, there's just no telling where our poets come from.
Yes.
Because someone asked me yesterday, well, what circumstances created the environment for you to be a poet? And I think it doesn't matter. Whatever circumstance you're in, you'll use. There's just no right circumstance.
I agree. I think it's more the person. Are you sensitive? I mean, I'm a kind of acutely sensitive to things. I mean, my sister grew up in a very similar circumstance. She's a lawyer. So, I mean, yeah. And so...
Tainted tuna for dessert. But we do get a little autobiographical detail because you had kissing coal.
Yeah.
That's a Pittsburgh, a tribute to Pittsburgh.
There were we lived on top of coal mines, and there were holes and sinkholes in the ground.
Kissing coal. Yeah. Reb Livingston, she thrills me, and she cheers me up, and she's upbeat. There is drama in her poetry. I mean, there's a lot going on in your poetry. There are characters, and do you think the way you get drama is by using actual words embedded in the poem, conversation?
Well, I don't consciously try to inject drama or sadness or anything like that. I kind of go into the little trance state, and then whatever comes out, comes out. I think a lot of it is based on what I, in a way, it won't be directly autobiographical, but it is based on where I am. I'm writing a book right now called God Damsel over the last year and a half, and I've written about 100 pages, and I can kind of compare the poems to like my dreams, like not at the time, but afterwards I'm like, oh, I have all these really negative animus poems. And I'm like, oh, yeah, in those months I just kept dreaming about all these random men assaulting me or attacking me or doing horrible things to me. And I wasn't consciously doing that. But if I take a few steps back, I can see that.
Well, we are going to want to know where you are at every minute. That's for sure. How is it now that you have this three-year-old? How does your poetry change being a mother? It changes things.
It definitely changes things, not in the way I suspected. I had this fear. Someone who doesn't have children, you know, it's like, once I become a parent, I'm going to become very lame and boring and very uncool. And I had that fear like everybody else. I'm like, oh, am I going to write breastfeeding poems and sippy cup poems? And, you know, because I knew that the people who seemed outwardly as mothers seemed to me, in my limited perspective, now I know that isn't the case, but I said, oh, I'm just going to change. And I haven't written any motherhood poems yet. In fact, I tend to, when I was pregnant and when I was the first year when I was had a baby throwing up on me every day, is when I wrote Your 10 Favorite Words. And aside from one reference to carrying around extra weight, there isn't any overt reference to a child. I mean, because I think my mind was kind of, my body was in one place, but my mind at certain times when I was writing was like, want to get the heck out of there. And so, I mean, even though, I mean,
you
I was.
You did notice that you had the baby, though.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, my every waking moment was about the baby.
We know. Let's hear another poem so we can decide for ourselves. Reb Livingston has many enterprises, which he's going to tell us about. And I will tantalize you with the title of one of them, The No-Tell Motel.
This poem actually is a kind of a Pittsburgh poem. It's about an amusement park. It's called Luna Park, 1907 to 1916. When nothing better bubbled your kiln, you looked for entrance. Why not? It was safe for you. The lions only ate women. You saw castle and carousel, never shades and shadows. She fastened her belt, endured the scenic railway until everything throbbed riot, licked cotton candy while you twirled the cardboard cone. You said shoot to shoot. She said, Temple of Mystery. You jumped the turnstile, yelling after the trolley. Desires vanish once you leave. It's always different on return. Rain checks bring ash, perhaps a fawn brief flash. Moonstruck girl, brushstroke, mighty Monongahela.
Moonstruck girl, brushstroke, pretty nice stuff.
Thanks.
Alliteration that just happens.
Yeah, I don't.
It just happens.
I don't intend. I don't try. I find it after I write it, but I don't.
As an editor, what do you look for when someone sends you a poem? Is it a very visceral reaction, or do you actually have a prejudice against certain kinds of poems?
I have, because the magazine is called No Tell Motel, it does sometimes attract the wrong kinds of poems, which I guess in a way I ask for. But anyone who read the magazine could see that it's not a bunch of sleazy, cheap,
it's
tawdry poems.
It's very classy magazine.
www.notellmotel.org.
All one word. Notellmotel.org.
.org.
And look it up. It's really a very colorful and exciting. Do you call it a magazine?
It is, yeah, an online magazine. Yes, we publish a new poet every week, a new poem every day.
And the blog is different.
The blog I just started a few weeks ago, just a way to, I have a couple hundred contributors now because the magazine is 4 years, and we do 52 poets. And then plus with The Bedside Guy, which is a print anthology companion that No Tell Books, my press, does. So there's a lot of poets out there with books or doing really interesting projects. And so it's a way to promote all these different poets who I've worked with. And I encourage them to write reviews or articles or little essays. Or I'm asking right now for the best poetry books of 2008 or holiday guides, anything to sort of get the word out. Because there's just, I know so many people with new books out and or projects or magazines or whatever it is, and it's just you don't get
thank
press.
You. I just want to say thank you. I mean, it's a stodgy term, but you're a literary citizen.
I try to contribute to the gift economy, which I believe poetry is.
Oh, the gift economy.
That's what I
like it, because everyone wants to be reviewed and nobody wants to review, and there's no place usually to get your reviews posted, and so you're changing that.
I'm trying to contribute to that. My book, Your 10 Favorite Words, has had a couple small reviews, and I think one may be coming up in Galatea Resurrects, but I haven't gotten many reviews, which I was kind of, I know I should have expected it, but I was shocked.
But it is just lately, it's 2007, right?
It's the end of 2007. It's been a year.
A year. Okay.
I think I had unrealistic expectations.
You're going to have to knock on doors.
I did it the wrong way. I did a lot of travel to do readings. And I did a tour up and on the East Coast, and it was difficult arranging the childcare, but I got it all done. And I, you know, in some places I would sell books, and other places there'd be an audience of like 80 people, and then I'd sell one book. You just never knew what's going to happen.
Reb, you are embodying the world of literature. Your own experience is pretty much a prism of the way it is. And the way it is all about poetry with us. If I could name what music your poetry would go to, what would that be? It certainly isn't Lullaby of Broadway.
Oh, goodness. You know, I've never thought of it that way.
Well, do. Give it some thought. We don't have to come up with an answer, because I know Dee Dee Menendez, who has Mi Poesia,
yes.
She's a friend of yours, sent a link about a musician she was now interested in. And I can always tell her poetry matches the music she's interested in.
Now,
what kind of music would be your soundtrack?
I suppose a lot of your 10 favorite words might have been influenced by Cyndi Lauper. It's true.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, so... goodness.
That is a good one. I wouldn't have guessed. Okay, let me think of that one.
I try not to do it very... I don't... It just maybe... It's something that clicks in me, and then I have a different response to it, which so I think it'd be very difficult for somebody who didn't know my brain.
But she's quite jazzy.
Yeah, I guess so.
She's quite jazzy,
yeah.
Too. Let's hear a poem. This is Reb Livingston. We are dissecting her process, and I like that.
And these are some poems from, I mentioned the new book I'm writing called God Damsel. So I'm basically, just very briefly, I'm rewriting translations of, say, Sumerian literature or Catholic prayers or the Egyptian Book of the Dead, a number of things. Most of these things are translations, and I am translating the translations.
So you got it in flat English from another language?
Yeah. So it was some scholar translated it to tell you.
This is such a good idea.
And my poems, unless I told you, you wouldn't know that. But that's what I'm doing with God Damsel. I'm totally,
God Damsel.
I'm rewriting all these spiritual texts into this. This is called Lament for Fronting. O damsel, how is your torso? How you tiptoe? O maiden, how is your torso? How your slip shows? O accomplished woman whose benefit now annulled, how do you abide? O nymphet whose downgrade unnerves your higher priestess, how is your torso? After your benefit annulled, now how do you abide? After your indulgence, your warmth and interest, how is your torso? Your tabernacle and worship, now how do you abide? Your altar turned to syrup? How is your torso? You are not the prized tulip in a field reduced to turnip rounds. You cannot wake up beloved in a meadow reeking fish. You cannot pose as impugn to those who sowed before you.
Will you give the attribution?
I will mention, right now I don't remember exactly which Sumerian, that's from a Sumerian scroll, and I'm ashamed to say I don't know exactly which scroll that, but I will be obviously in my acknowledgments mentioning the source.
But just that we knew that it was that Sumerian scroll would be enough to me.
I think so. Yeah. I think I want to keep plenty of mystery, and I obviously don't want to give away all my trade secrets, especially because I don't remember them or know them.
But there's so much humor in you. You're so sassy, and there's so much goodwill and humor and fun. Did you always look at the world through such a humorous way?
Yes, because I'm so sad.
That's it,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I was, as in middle school, I realized like the cool girl could be my friend if I was funny.
This is so excellent because I say to you, have you always looked at the world humorously? And you say, yes, because I am so sad. That is just perfect. It says so much. It tells us everything. Let's hear another poem. Reb Livingston.
This is called Spell for Sipping Elixir and Not Being Learnt by Sunburst.
What is the source? Do you remember?
This is the Egyptian Book of the Dead. They have all the spells. And the spells are for what do you do once you die? I mean, like for all these things, how to get your soul to wherever it needs to go or whatever. O spoon swirl of Sunburst, I am wrought with snot, for I am bomb swell from which the gourd was sewed. I will be neither learnt nor scored, for I am prophetess, eldest of the gourd, for all the coven grunt trembles with her eye on Tabor Shrillville. I am the traverse Clara Blunt, when damsel is lost in hoop skirt. My name will carry furlong and a big wick.
And another. This is Reb with her translations.
Lament for Beau. He disenchanted his miscreant, let his mental somersaults obstruct her obligatory blindness. The wilted stud disenchanted his miscreant, and his mental somersaults obstructed her obligatory blindness. The undercover lover disenchanted it and obstructed her obligatory blindness. Wrong Juan disenchanted the sham and allowed his mental somersaults to obstruct her obligatory blindness. His apron disenchanted the home because his mental somersaults obstructed her obligatory blindness. It was a long time coming. Apron disenchanted that house, and his mental somersaults found way to attach laps. The shenanigans disenchanted it, and his mental somersault attached laps. The holler collar first disenchanted his apron, and then disenchanted his miscreant, while letting his mental somersaults attach laps and obstruct blindness. One is disengaged, the other has sight.
What did you learn when you were at Bennington that allowed you to do this? Or actually, you got your undergraduate from Bennington.
From Carnegie Mellon.
Oh, Carnegie Mellon. You got your undergraduate, and then you got your Master's of Fine Arts in Writing from Bennington.
Yeah, that's...
What did they do to you? What did you take away that allows you to fly so high?
Well, Carnegie Mellon, I was more just learning the beginnings. I was invited back last year, or early this year, actually, in spring, to Jim Daniels assigned my book to his class, which was thrilling. And I came back and I spoke to the class, and Jerry Costanza, who's the editor of Carnegie Mellon Press, you know, I was a student of his as well. And he said, oh, your lines are so different. And I said, you remember my lines? I don't know if he did. He said he did. And so
as a teacher, I can remember what my students wrote.
I barely remembered my lines. I mean, so as an undergrad, I just think I was just learning very basics. And then I worked for 4 years, and then I went to grad school. And my work was very different at Bennington. And so I'm sure Bennington played a role in how I write now, but it wasn't, I wouldn't say, if there was anything, it was me kind of rebelling against Bennington. When I was at Bennington, I was very happy there. I liked it very much. And for a few years afterwards, I was kind of like their little cheerleader. And then I kind of turned on them. Not turned on them, but turned on the idea, some of the man of letters ideas, the ideas of greatness and the idea of the canon. And I thought they were very limiting and very, the way, at least the way I understood it. And so I kind of was like, well, forget that. And I started focusing on DIY, do-it-yourself work. And I started really getting in touch with what a lot of people, maybe not far outside of the academy, but people on the fringes were doing. And that to me was just so much more interesting, and I could connect so much better with that.
But isn't defiance part of conformity? I mean, isn't that what it's about?
I was a good student when I did what I was supposed to when I was there, and I think they had positive impression of me, but it didn't really work for me once I finished.
But it did work, and look, because look what you did. You renounced it to break new ground. And you are among all the younger generation, I have to say. Those with three-year-old babies we call the younger generation. And you are really making moves out there. You don't look back. You don't worry about censorship or judgment. You have a class act. You really are bright and unafraid, and I really want to congratulate you for that. You really have courage.
Well, that means a lot to me to hear you say that, and thank you. I guess I try not to be conscious of that. If someone says something to me that, oh, you're being courageous by doing that, I'm really not. I just want to write, and I want to publish, and I want to contribute to the poetry community. And I'm just trying to think of ways to do it, which I don't think I've thought of anything particularly groundbreaking or anything very risky. My life isn't at risk. My life, you know, I don't have to worry about being thrown into jail. So I don't see it quite that other people do, because people seem to be very frightened about doing anything different. Or,
well, I think in kindergarten you put your rug on sideways when everybody else put their rug upside down to sleep. I'm sure your rug was sideways. You just love the new. You just love the new.
I do like the new.
Let's hear another poem. I think, give us your best shot. Give us a poem you don't want to go away without.
Okay, I'll read this one. Lament for Ha. Oh, Bo, this lament snickers. This lament chokes its milk for you. Your lament snickers, oh, Bo. This lament chokes its milk for you. In afflicted melodrama, Bo's miscreant snorts one mean lament. In afflicted melodrama, the miscreant pines and snorts. This lament snickers. This lament choking its milk for you. Your lament snickers, oh, Bo. This lament chokes its milk for you. In your orchestrated wreck, the lament snickers. How long will your snickering lament snort her milk? How long will your snickering lament choke the one who pines? Cold storage. Farewell to frosty things, to that shivering shoebox. If sentiment means making cabbage of things, if cabbage presumes intimacy, if silence weaves tongues, if the city signals tendrils, if tendrils are wintered and false, the ankle cramp, the shrivel, all Bloody Mary mix, all horse, all ice, all daggers and sugar cubes. Darling, it's time. If all you can come up with is a thought, adieu.
I see one more. We can't go away without that one.
Okay. Lament for Origin. From muddled clay where this book was founded, O Sultana, the vain glum peasants who huddled your ankles, bring their flippers for your spatula, whooshing like damseled whorls before you. May the foreskin tribes cast better wishes, make curtsy pies and cabbage kowtow soup. In your meadow slashed a stubby lub, may this lament dwindle to your pheasant-licked toes. Like a golden-pricked massage, may you not be spiritless. May this mud become your broth.
Reb Livingston, only she could make a lament sparkle out loud. And that is the voice of Reb. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. The series is funded by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. Our associate producer is Ken Flynn. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.